Welcome to Hollywood Terriers, the BULA podcast. I'm Cody Broder, your host and proud graduate of Boston University and the Boston University Los Angeles program. Every week I'll be taking you inside conversations I'm having with some of BU's most successful alumni about their college journeys and their subsequent journeys in Hollywood. Today's guest is my fellow alumnus and powerhouse, Krista Vernoff, the Emmy-nominated television writer, producer, and current showrunner of Grey's Anatomy, which is perhaps one of the most successful TV shows in the history of the medium. I take you now inside an inspiring conversation Krista and I had at her office.
My sister went to BU before me, to what is now the College of Fine Arts, but was called School for the Arts back then, SFA. And I had been visiting her for 2 years at BU. We went to high school in upstate New York and Troy, New York. And we were both actors, and I wanted to be an acting major. And I actually didn't want to go to BU because my sister went there, and I wanted to go make a name for myself somewhere else. Even though it was really, at the time, it was the second best acting program in the country after Juilliard had been ranked. So I applied to, I loved BU, but I kind of didn't want to go. And then that's where I got in a few places, but that they gave me a really helpful financial aid package. And I had already made friends there, and it was a natural fit, and I was really happy to go.
Made friends there through hanging out
through my sister. Yes, it was like I didn't want to go, follow in her footsteps and be in her shadow. And then it was, I was thrilled to go to BU.
My dad also went to BU, and I had the same, like, I didn't want to because of that reason.
Right.
But that didn't happen.
You wanted to forge your own path.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's really interesting. That's a like Nina Tassler, right? She went to study acting at BU, and then something very different happened after that. So you did study, like, theater?
Yes, I was an acting major, 4-year conservatory program acting major. I took one writing class at BU. I took a playwriting class from John Lipsky my senior year.
Oh, cool.
And I had a feeling after that class that I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't make the change for a few years after I graduated.
What was that change like? When did that happen? Like, what led to that, you think?
Well, I took that playwriting class, and I had sort of a burst of an awakening. Like, I wanted to be a writer, and it was abundantly clear to me that I had insecurities and neuroses as an actor that I did not have as a writer. I wrote and produced a play in that class, and I directed the freshmen in the program in that play, and I loved it. I came alive. And I told everybody, my family and friends, that I wanted to be a writer. This was my senior year at BU.
Wow.
And BU at that time was a cuts-based conservatory training program. What that means is we started with 54 freshmen in our class, and we were graduating 14 of them. They had cut. There were talent-based cuts every year. It was an incredibly difficult, incredibly competitive. It was the number two program in the country after Juilliard. And so here I was about to graduate in that program, and I had taken one writing class, and I was saying, I don't want to be an actor, I want to be a writer. And so the people in my life who loved me persuaded me that I was probably just afraid to go try to be an actor. And at that time in my life, I believed them, that this must just be fear, that nobody wants to suddenly and abruptly their senior year of this program completely change their focus. Oh. And so I moved to New York with the focus of being an actor, along with most of my class. And while I was there, I took the first year out of school, I took a screenwriting class at the New School in New York.
Oh, yeah.
And then I really knew I wanted to be a writer, but I still felt I had something to prove to the people who were telling me I was just afraid to try to be an actor. And so I moved to Portland, Oregon, because I had a boyfriend who wanted to go to massage school there, and I had a couple of BU classmates who were making their living acting there, Michaela Watkins and Peter Page.
Oh, my God.
And I moved to Portland, and after I spent 2 years there, and the first year I was waiting tables, and by the second year I was making my living acting.
Wow.
Because it was, my training was very effective from BU. This was a much smaller pond. My training made me a bigger fish, and I got my equity card, and I did three, Lort A plays that year, and I felt after I had made my living acting for a full year that I had proven something really to myself, which is that I wasn't afraid and that I could make my living acting and that writing was still really singing to me. I was writing all the time in Portland. I was meeting friends in coffee shops by day and writing all day and then going and performing at night. And it was very clear that that's where my passion now lived and that that's where my heart lived. And I remember I was doing a play at Portland Center Stage, which was like the gig everybody wanted. And I was running off stage between scenes. I was writing in the green room. I was writing screenplays with a pencil and paper because this was a long time ago. I didn't have a laptop. I don't even know if they had laptops. Yeah. But anyway, it became really clear to me and everyone around me that this was that this shift had taken place and I needed to pursue it.
That's so cool. And and so it became clear to family and friends or the people who loved you too.
Yeah, no, they continued to struggle. When I moved to Los Angeles that year at the end, I closed that show and I packed up a car and I moved to LA. I put my headshots in storage. I never told anyone I was an actor. I came here exclusively to pursue a job as a TV writer. My family really struggled with that. I'm the only person maybe in history whose family really struggled with her desire to quit acting. So they really struggled. And they kept saying, well, why don't you? They kept sending me links to acting companies that also you could be a writer, like Write Act and things like that. And I stayed the course. I felt really clear. For some reason, I understood intuitively that coming to Los Angeles as a hyphenate, people take you less seriously. If you walk around and you go, I'm a writer and an actor, you have to pick one and focus on it utterly and create success there, and then you can open those other doors for yourself. But coming in and saying, I'm a writer, actor, director is much, much harder path. So I just told my family I was really clear and I had proven to myself what I needed to prove. Mm-hmm. And I stayed the course, and within a year of moving here, I was working as a writer. I was really lucky.
Well, not necessarily, maybe.
Well, and I think it takes talent and it takes hard work and it takes a little bit of luck. Mm-hmm. I think all of those things are true.
Mm-hmm. What was that
first job?
Writing job that was like, and now I'm a professional writer.
Yeah. My first writing job was a freelance assignment for Law and Order. Right. And I remember what's funny about that, my training from BU serves me all the time still today, even though it was a conservatory actors training program. Everybody I know who trained in that program with me, who is no longer an actor, is served by that training every day. We are my friends. Many of the people who I graduated BU with are very successful writers and producers. And I think part of why we're so successful is that we were taught how to sit in a room and perform and sit in a room and talk and invite people into our imaginations. We were taught how to vocalize. We were taught how to sit up straight. We were taught how to play the role of a queen in Shakespeare and to present ourselves like someone successful. And all of these things come into play. So many writers are so shy and they're so introverted. And you, in order to get writing work in Hollywood, you have to sit in a room and talk to people and persuade them that they should pay you a lot of money to put your vision on paper. And BU taught us, our theater training taught us how to do that. So what I remember about my meeting for Law and Order is that I had been acting for a couple of years and I had had agents in Portland where I was going out for commercials and things. And it was always like I had my wardrobe, like upscale casual, you know, it was like, do you wear a suit for this or is this like, and I had this meeting at Law and Order and it was my first ever meeting. And I dressed for that meeting as if I was auditioning for Law and Order. So I put on like a business suit, the only business suit I owned, and heels. And I went in and I felt like I was playing dress up, presented myself as a professional. And I remember I stopped into my agents who had just signed me after, and I thought they'd be so impressed with my upscale casual business attire. And they kind of reprimanded me and said, you know, in Hollywood, they want the talent to look like talent. You look like a lawyer. Like you look like you're auditioning to play a lawyer. It's more appropriate maybe to wear jeans and a casual top because writer, that's like, so that's how writers dress or something.
Right.
So it was all an education for me, but, but even though I was transitioning careers, my BU training, was fundamental and continues to be.
And, Even before that, do you remember as a kid acting or writing ever being on your mind?
Well, what I remember is that for as long as I can remember, I did not like to write papers. Huh. I liked to write dialogues. Like, I wrote the first play I ever wrote. I wrote in the third grade. I remember in seventh grade, I was supposed to write a paper, and I decided to write a dialogue between Hitler and Stalin. Like, I imagined a dialogue. So, yes, writing came very organically to me. And I also won the writing awards in high school. Wow. Like, I won the Regents, like, there's in New York State, there's the Regents exams. Yeah. And I won the New York State Regents exam writing award.
Wow.
And my thought at that time was, wow, I really pulled something over on them, because that was so easy for me. And I am, so in my head, I think this is a thing kids often have to learn, is that which comes easy to us, we think of it, I sort of thought everyone can do this. This isn't special. The smart people can do math, because I couldn't do math. The smart people can pay attention in geography, you know. But my natural talents were so at the forefront that I dismissed them. Acting was harder for me. I was very insecure as an actor. Writing came easily to me, and I am, I think, maybe a little more of an exception to this rule. A lot of writers I know struggle more, but the writing always came easy to me. I would write those essays really quick. I understood putting words together very organically, and so I dismissed it. I never took a special writing class. I never thought writing was a unique gift. I thought you're supposed to, I don't know, I thought you had to work harder to in the areas where you should study or excel, or I don't know. But it took me until my senior year of college to understand that I had a gift, even though I was winning awards for it. You know,
Wow. What about movies and TV growing up? Do you remember? I mean, and did you ever think, was there, like, that's a business or something that I...
No, yeah. I didn't think about becoming a TV writer or a movie writer until I took that screenwriting class at the New School after I had graduated from BU. And there, that teacher told me, I wish I remembered her name, but off of my classwork, she told me that I should look into TV writing. I was looking at movie writing, and she said, you have an incredible ear for dialogue, and TV is a dialogue medium, and a film is a more visual medium. And so then I started studying TV shows. But prior to that, when you say, what about TV and movies, I wasn't allowed. I was allowed to watch 1 hour of TV a week growing up. So I think it's hilarious that I became a TV writer.
Yeah.
And I think the fact that I was an avid, avid reader, I think because I wasn't allowed to watch TV. Like, I struggle with my 10-year-old now. I'm like, she won't read for pleasure. And I realize it's because I don't do a good enough job of restricting her screen time. Because when I did that a little more firmly in the last couple of weeks, she started reading. If that's your choice, that's what you do.
Yeah.
So I was an avid reader because my mom wouldn't let me watch TV. And I think that is why I became a storyteller. I immersed myself and lost myself in books and stories. I loved certain TV shows, the TV shows that I would watch, and I would sneak and watch more than an hour of TV a week, but I couldn't get that much in. So I watched Charlie's Angels, you know, sometimes I would watch Fantasy Island, but I wasn't allowed to watch much TV. So most of the shows that everybody grew up on, I didn't. And then movies, I was exposed very young to a lot of, I moved for 4 years when I was a kid. We moved to Utah. We lived in Heber City, Utah, and then Park City, Utah, from Venice Beach, California, which was a culture shock, and I think also made me a writer. But that was at the very beginning of the Sundance Film Festival. And so I saw Sophie's Choice at Sundance when I was 10 years old.
Oh, dear.
Try to imagine processing Sophie's Choice as a 10-year-old. But my parents were not super great at editing or at... restricting that kind of content. Like, my mom had these firm rules about TV because she thought it dumbed you down, but I saw The Shining when I was 8 and Carrie when I was 6, and so movies were very traumatic for me. I think I never imagined writing them for that reason. I fell in love with stories and storytelling, and then I went to BU and I studied theater and I studied, read all the plays and studied all the great playwrights, contemporary and throughout history. And I just loved words. I just loved words. Mm-hmm. And then, gosh, I don't know what prompted me to take a screenwriting class. Maybe John Lipsky, who was teaching me playwriting. He definitely told me I had a gift and a talent and that I should take more writing classes. I don't know what prompted me to take that screenwriting class.
That's interesting. Do you remember anything else from BU? It sounds like the program was so rigorous, and it still has a reputation for being like really rigorous. Mm-hmm. Like those kids bunker down in the conservatory.
Well, that program, talk about rigorous. Like, I think it still is. Uh-huh. I think they've changed the cuts program now. People are not cut, right. Although they are sift. Like, there's the acting program, then there's theater studies program. So you used to be cut, and when you were cut from the school. You were cut, and mostly your credits didn't even apply anywhere else. Like, it was really intense.
Wow.
Now you get, I think, invited into the acting program or not. And what I understand is that they've improved the theater studies program to such a degree that kids don't feel slighted. It's like the teachers decide you should study classical acting specifically, or you should have a more full-fledged theatrical education, and either way is really great. Mm-hmm. I think that's a much better system than what we were going through. Mm-hmm. But it was, you would see other kids had, you know, a couple classes during the day, and then they had a lot of homework at night, and yes. then they went to parties.
Yes.
At SFA, back then, and I think still now, my class schedule was 9 to 11 a.m. I had a class, 11 to 1 I had a class, I had a break from 1 to 2, and then I had a class from 2 to 4, I had a class from 4 to 6, and then I had rehearsal every night from 7 to 11.
Oh my God.
So you were in school from 9 a.m. till 11 p.m. with an hour off for lunch and an hour off for dinner. And then you had to figure out when to write papers and do homework. It was no joke, that training.
I think a lot of film students hearing this will be shocked by that. That's amazing.
The conservatory acting program, you were in history of theater from 9 to 11 and voice and speech from 11 to 1 and lunchtime. And then from 2 to 4, you had acting. And from 4 to 6, you had movement. And then you had an hour off. And from 7 to 11, you were in stagecraft season 1. So you were learning how to build the sets. And I'm sorry, not season 1. Freshman year. Uh-huh. Stagecraft freshman year. And then for the next 3 years, you were always rehearsing a play or performing. So it was intense. And we have a tremendous education for it. Like I said, I use those movement lessons today. I use those voice and speech lessons today. Wow. I use those focus lessons today. I learned empathy and compassion in my acting classes that I have to use in my job and in my writing today. I was steeped like a teabag in dialogue because I was reading plays constantly and articulating constantly. And all of that made me the writer that I am.
Yeah. Well, and that makes, so much sense. So there's the Law and Order episode, and then what exactly happens after that for you?
I wrote an episode of Law and Order, and that same season I was staffed on a show called Time of Your Life, which was a spinoff of Party of Five. It starred Jennifer Garner and Jennifer Love Hewitt, and that went 18 episodes, and then I went back out into staffing season, and I was staffed on Charmed for 3 years. I did 3 seasons of Charmed. I left Charmed, and I was staffed that season on Wonder Falls on Fox, which went 13 episodes. I got married. It got canceled while I was on my honeymoon. Mm. They went 2 and out. Like, we made 13, but they aired 2. Mm. I came back into staffing season. I was staffed on Grey's Anatomy.
Wow.
I stayed on Grey's Anatomy seasons 1 through 7.
Yeah.
I made a pilot season 1 that didn't go. I made a pilot season 7 that I left the show to go make. I was so certain it was going to go to series. It didn't go to series. Shonda called and asked if I wanted to do some part-time work on Private Practice because I had left Grey's to make the pilot, and I had trained my replacements. And and I really wanted to be home with my kid more. And so I worked part-time kind of rewriting scripts from home on private practice for a couple of seasons, and I wrote and produced pilots that didn't go to series. Many of them came very close, and they all tested really well. Pilots don't go to series for very strange reasons in Hollywood. Like, the person who ordered the pilot got fired, and that's happened to me twice, and really random stuff.
Are those like somewhat devastating?
Devastating. Okay. They're devastating. Okay. They're not devastating so much anymore.
Yeah, because when
the
you
first
talk about
five
it,
times it happens, you go to bed. You know, it's really, you kill yourself to make that thing, and you pour your heart and your soul into it, and you work 90 hours a week, and it's incredibly intense, and you fall in love with the cast and the stories that you want to tell, and then it dies on the vine. And that is really heartbreaking, and it's part of the gig in Hollywood. Is just, if I were still an actor, it's the same thing. You get a job or you don't get a job. You go and do a few episodes, and then you're unemployed again. There's the insecurity of a life in Hollywood is... when people say, what makes you someone who should pursue a career in the arts versus having arts as a hobby, my answer is always your comfort level with instability. Right. How comfortable are you with high highs and low lows and a roller coaster as a lifestyle? The instability is constant in the arts. And so I'm pretty comfortable with a high level of instability. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so I made pilots that didn't go and wrote for Shonda. And then a year after I left Grey's, while I was still working with Shonda on private practice, I got a meeting with John Wells, and he asked me to come join him at Shameless, which I did for 4 or 5 seasons, and that was a joy.
Yeah.
I did one season where I was working on private practice and Shameless and writing pilots. And in the 7 years that I left Grey's Anatomy, 6 years, because I left in the middle of season 7, and I came back at the beginning of season 14. I wrote 12 pilots, and I made 4 of them. And I was on staff full-time. I was an executive producer at Shameless, writing 2 episodes a season. And then Shonda called and said, let's have lunch. And the next thing I knew, I mean, I've never been more shocked in my life. If you had asked me to name 100 things I might be doing this year, running Grey's Anatomy again would not have been one of them. But she, you know, she offered me what I'd been trying to get all with all those pilots, which is my own show. She trusts me. She knows me. She knows that I share her voice and her vision, and she let me take the reins of this show, and that was a sweet enough offer to come back, and it's been a real joy.
That's great.
Yeah.
What do you have, like, when you're saying how many things you were doing at once, is there like a routine of any kind you have for this stuff? Like, I know a lot of recent writer grads are struggling with that. Like, do I pick hours during the day or something that I block off for writing? Like, how did you just bounce? Did you do it because you had to?
It was much easier. It's much easier for me personally to have too much work than too little.
Oh, wow.
There's no question of like, when am I doing my writing, when you have to work, when you have deadlines that are real and paid and somebody's going to shoot that hour of TV. That's why I love TV way more. I've written a couple of feature films. They don't get made. You spend 2 years writing them and then they get stuck on a shelf. TV, I write it, and 2 weeks later, it's shot.
It's amazing.
Sometimes a week later or the next day, depending on how long I waited to write. But if it's shooting, it's shooting, and I've got to write it. And I write it whenever I have, you know what I mean? I write it in whatever moment I have to write. There's routine and I are allergic to each other.
Okay.
I prefer a little bit of chaos. And I can write, I am particularly lucky in this regard, is I can write, like, people go, what do you need in order to write? I can write anywhere, and I can write with, you know, I can write in a coffee shop, and I do my best writing on airplanes, and and I don't need, you know, silence and meditation, and I can harness the chaos and put the words on paper, and it's a little chaotic. Uh-huh. If I didn't have people now who I pay to clean up behind me, like, that's where it would be really filthy. I've been watching Queer Eye on Netflix, yeah, and I laugh because they walk into these houses and they're just chaos, and they're like, how do you live like this? And there's just food everywhere and plates everywhere and clothes everywhere and no laundry's been done and the toilet hasn't been scrubbed and it's disgusting, and that would be me. 100%. My writing would be done, but that's what my life would look like. And I make no apology.
Can you talk about the short film you made for the 2016 Redstones?
Yeah. I actually made two short films that were in the 2016 Redstones. I produced two of them. I wrote both of them.
Wow.
And I produced both of them, and I wrote both of them, and I directed one of them. And the one that I directed won the Redstones.
That's the one I know about, Stars?
Yes, yeah, Stars. Okay. I was super proud of Stars. I made Stars because my pilot had not gone that season. And when a pilot doesn't go, like, it's one thing when you've written the script and it doesn't get made, but when you make the pilot and then it doesn't go to series for some unbelievably stupid reason, when you tested really high and the cast was phenomenal and you did your job exactly right, and one person's taste or sensibility kills your dream, it's really, really profoundly painful and defeating. And I've written about this. You know, the first time I made a pilot and it didn't go, I went to bed for 3 weeks. And the last time I made a pilot and it didn't go, I went to bed for 3 hours because I have a kid now, and you know what I mean? It's, I have to take care of her and her feelings. And also you get a thicker skin, and but it's still shitty. And when that pilot didn't go, I had a feeling that I needed to make something that I could control and put out into the world. Like, that I keep making these beautiful, beautiful projects that don't get put out into the world. They never get seen by anyone. And I thought, I just can't go through that again without doing something that I can put out into the world, that I can give birth to all the way. And I had been having an inkling that I wanted to try directing. And so I did some praying and meditating, like I do, for sort of what do I want to make? And this vision, it just came to me. I was sitting with my boyfriend eating lunch, and I said, I gotta run inside. And I ran inside and grabbed my computer, and I wrote this thing down. I wrote the script in 20 minutes. I ran inside and wrote the script. Now, it's a 7-minute short film. It's 5 pages. Mm-hmm. But I knew exactly what it was. The whole thing came to me. And what was extraordinary about that is that I think in dialogue. Dialogue comes to me. But this had almost no dialogue.
Right.
Like, it all came to me as visuals. I knew the story that I wanted to tell. I wrote it almost exclusively as visuals, with one, like, direct address monologue mm-hmm. that runs throughout it. And any other dialogue, that's almost every other bit of dialogue that's in the movie, the actors improvised. I knew that if I was going to direct, I needed to think visually, and I kind of asked for that, and it came, and I wrote it down. And then I called Abigail Spencer, who had starred in two pilots for me and become a close friend. And I said, you know, I wrote this thing and I want to make it. And I sent it to her. And 10 minutes later, she said, yeah, I'm in. Wow. And she said, you know, I just worked with this DP. He was incredible. And I went and I met with the DP, and he was like, yeah, I'm in. And then I said to Michael Medico, will you help me? And who was a friend from BU, who I knew to be a really good producer of events, not of films, I think, up until that point. But he had produced this incredible AIDS benefit, Hot in Hollywood. And I just wanted to do something with my friends. I just want to do something for me with my friends. Mm. And so then I called, and I'm aware of my blessings. Like, I'm surrounded by extraordinary talent who I've worked with a lot, and I've cultivated those relationships. So I was able to call Wes Brown, who I had done a pilot with, and Josh Kelly, who I had done a pilot with, and Janine Mason, who I had done a pilot with, and say, will you come do this thing with me? And they all said yes. And I wrote the checks. Like, I funded the film myself. I was lucky to be able to do that too, blessed to be able to do that. And also, I will say, willing to do that. A lot of people don't want to write big checks to make their own little, it's like I made my own little movie in the backyard, literally in my backyard. Wow. We shot it in my house. Wow. And we shot it in my house and in locations around Los Angeles that we got, you know, basically for free because we just had to get filming permits. We stole one location because we couldn't get a permit. That was super stressful. Super stressful. Yeah. And then and my stepmom's house. We borrowed my stepmom's house and we just put together a team of people and we shot it over the weekend. We shot it in 2 days. Wow. It was 5 pages. It was 2 days. Abigail was extraordinary, and she and I had such a shorthand. And as a writer and showrunner, you work so closely with the actors anyway. And TV is really a showrunner medium. It's a writer's medium. The writer showrunner has the last word in TV, whereas the director has the last word in film. Yeah. So I was used to working with actors closely, and those parts of directing came really organically to me, and I just loved it. I just loved it. It was like a great big arts and craft project that I got to make and that nobody could kill. Right. Nobody could tell me that I couldn't put it out into the world. And so I made it and I edited it in like the friend of a friend's living room. And we put it out into the world and we got into a bunch of film festivals and it won the Red Stones, which was really meaningful to me.
Yeah.
And I love it. I'm really proud of it. And what's ironically, it's like the darkest thing I've ever written. It's not, mostly what I write is comedy, and there's not a line of comedy in that piece.
Right.
I think because I knew that comedy is harder to direct, and I wanted to try something that I knew for sure that I could execute.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a really beautiful little study. It's a little study on child abuse, actually, and the long-term effects.
Speaking of abuse, if we could get into this for a second, because you've been so wonderful on the issues lately with the Me Too and Time's Up. It's like, I talked to a male friend recently, straight white male, BU grad, who was like, I want to know what to do as an ally.
Mm.
Like, because we consider ourselves these super woke, liberal guys, but we're all straight white dudes in this. I'm in a group thread with friends from BU.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any advice on that besides giving money to two Time's Up or some of these organizations like and especially as we're talking about BU, I'm thinking about college and the sort of the stuff that's going on at campuses and even was when I was there with mm-hmm. like people claiming there's blurred lines when in fact it's consent or not.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any advice to
That's such an interesting question, and it's one I haven't been asked. I have been vocal in asking my peers in Hollywood who are men to raise their voices in support of Me Too and Time's Up. I feel like these movements need the support of the whole community. The we don't want to be abused anymore. We don't want abuse to thrive in our culture anymore. Movement cannot be exclusively a women's movement. It has to be everybody saying we don't want abuse to thrive anymore. Now, I will tell you that the funniest, most effective thing I've seen on consent, bar none, is a tweet. And I don't know who wrote it, and I should look. I retweeted it, and I said, this is the tweet of the year. She said, any woman who's ever tried to put her finger in the ass of a straight man knows that they fundamentally understand consent and ongoing consent. They only get confused when women are involved.
Wow.
And I laughed super hard because, oh my God, is that true? Men understand consent and ongoing consent. They just do. Like, just because I said yes doesn't mean I mean yes to anything you want to do and that I can't change my mind a minute later if it hurts is really true. And I think that white male artists particularly could probably speak a white male language that, you know what I mean? Like, could you make art about that kind of thing? Could you create something for college students that's for incoming college freshmen that's about consent and bring it to BU and say, can this become a part of your orientation weekend? Could you, because you who are woke mm-hmm. and who understand the concepts of consent and ongoing consent, could you use your talents and your voice and your humor and your face and the fact that people by nature have far less unconscious bias towards people who look like you? Could you grab a platform? One of the resentments I have, one of the problems I have culturally right now is that I don't like men being told to shut up. I don't like the notion of mansplaining. I don't like the shaming of men who try to participate in the conversation. I'm not a fan of that. I think that, let's go a little deep here, that patriarchy is about me over you and the shutting down of one and the rising up of another and a leader and it's been the white male culture is the patriarchy and it sort of shuts out all others. And what I believe is that a matriarchy that where male energies run in straight lines, matriarchal energies, maternal energies run in circles. And that a matriarchy has to be, in order to be a matriarchy, it has to be inclusive. And it has to pause and educate wherever possible and to help men who are trying to be allies and not tell them to shut up. And so I would encourage my own gender to help any men who want to help us, help them help us. And I would encourage you to use your voice and make art that supports, particularly, I think, outside of Hollywood right now, what it all is coming down to is rape culture. Mm. What it's coming down to is this pretending that consent, that we don't understand it, or that it need not exist, or that it's blurry and confusing. And I don't know if you saw that little tea vignette that was going around a few years ago where they explained the concept of consent through the concept of if a neighbor came over for a cup of tea and you offered them a cup of tea and they said no thank you, maybe you'd offer it one more time, but if they said no thank you again, you would not proceed to make them a cup of tea. If they did say they'd like a cup of tea, you would pour them a cup of tea, but if they then fell asleep, you would not pour the tea down their throat. Really basic, but these things can be really impactful. Yeah. And I encourage you to make something, you know? Or you can make something about the confusion that you guys are all feeling right now. Perpetuate the conversation because it needs to be perpetuated by all of us. We need to keep having it. Just like the never again, the gun movement right now, we need to keep having these conversations. We cannot let them be drowned out by new news cycles.
Right, right. Okay, thank you. That was really helpful. Probably a great place to end. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really lovely to talk to BU, which I love.
Good.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening. Make sure to subscribe for more conversations with BU alumni and follow us on twitter.com/BULA podcast and facebook.com/BULA podcast. Special thanks to Noah Eberhardt, Mike Leone, and for the song that's playing right now, V-Neck Sweater.